Dit is Bek Lekker de podcast van ondernemer Maartje Nelissen
en foodtrendwatcher Gijsbrecht Brouwer.
Met trends, tips en ook alles wat op ons bord voorbij komt. Vandaag hebben we een bijzondere editie van Bek Lekker. Samen met Slow Food de podcast duiken we in foodtrends van over heel de wereld. We hebben input van experts uit onder meer de Filipijnen, Bolivia, Nigeria, Oeganda, Polen en Italië. Deze podcast is in het Engels en mijn gast is Valentina Gritti van Slow Food Youth Network. We bespreken trends van over de hele wereld deze podcast, dus geniet van de show. Luister vooral tot het eind, want dan geven Valentina en ik nog een tip om zelf mee aan de slag te gaan. There's a special edition today of both our podcasts. So let's start with a small introduction. Valentina, who are you?
Hi, Gijsbrecht. Thank you so much for this great opportunity of recording together. My name is Valentina Gritti and I'm the Global Community and Project Manager of Slow Food Youth Network, which is an international movement of youth and also people that work for a better food system, good, clean and fair food system. And I'm also the host of Slow Food, the podcast.
I'm going to tell that she's also... importer of cacao, of high-grade cacao from Mexico, also with a slow food story behind it. So it's not two different things, but it is two different things. And that's why I know you. That's what why I wanted to say it. I met you at the Oogstmarkt here in Rotterdam, the local farmers market, where you were selling this cacao, which I thought was really nice. And we get to know each other a bit better. And we decided to do this podcast. Now I'm going to answer your question. I'm Gijsbrecht Brouwer. I live in Rotterdam. I am the founder of De Buik, which is a Dutch platform for where to eat out. And it translates loosely like the belly. You know, we talk about things that go into the belly. A lot of people read that in the Netherlands. We have it online. We have it in social media. We have it in the newsletter. And we have a magazine. We just launched our third magazine yesterday. Really happy about that. I'm also a food trend watcher. So those things combine really well nicely. And so I look out where the world of food and drinks is headed. And I try to share this knowledge with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting. And actually, it's true that we met at the Oogstmarkt, which is a farmer's market in Rotterdam. We both live in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And normally in our podcast, we talk about slow lifestyle, especially with practical tips on how to live slow. And then I met Gijsbrecht and I thought, oh, we really have to do a podcast together on food trends. And so I sent out a message in our podcast community and I asked like, hey, guys, what do you think about making a podcast about food trends for next year? And they were really enthusiasts. And so I contacted you back and I thought we should definitely record this together. Me personally, I'm not really looking into trends, but I coordinate a global network of young people that are change makers and I really know a lot about local food trends. So what I did is that I asked also for their input. So we have a lot of different suggestions, inputs from local communities in different parts of the world that we can also mention today and also make a comparison between what they see in their cities, in their countries, and what you see here in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam, but also in more broader in Europe.
It's going to be a very global edition of Bek Lekker and the Slow Food podcast. So that's really nice. And we already checked these trends and they're going to be really interesting. And it's also nice to match them. And I think trends can have people feel that they are very TikTok-y, very fast, very flashy, very hype-driven, and some of them are. But I look at trends much broader than that. You know, I look at the underlying drivers, what's making a change, how are these impacting the food system, how are they impacting the different actors and players in the world of food and drinks, and how is this in the end leading to different food products or services or drinks or whatever, different concepts for shops or for restaurants or whatever, and how does the, in the end, the consumer see different food, eat different food, experience different food and drinks. And especially the last part is really important for me. I have studied economics, business economics here in Rotterdam. And I always think, of course, there's the complex system, which you are trying to change every day a little bit with the slow food movement. But also there's the people that actually, in the end, are the consumers, and they can change and they impact each other. So it's interesting to see both.
Yeah, definitely. But I'm also curious to know more about how you got into trends watching. So what is a bit of your history?
Yeah, I could do a whole podcast about that. So I'll keep it very briefly. After my studies, I always focus on the consumer. And I've always been someone who traveled a lot, who read a lot, who listened a lot. So I got a lot of input, and I always processed that somewhere in my head. And I started giving that back to people. I was on television. I worked for magazines. I wrote for newspapers. And from that on, I decided to help my clients with that. So I worked for a lot of big companies in the Netherlands and in Europe. And I always saw I'm basically doing the same thing, you know, trying to form a community around content, around insights, around people, actually, usually for brands, not always for brands. So I started doing this also around food in Rotterdam 12 years ago, which is the buik, the belly. And this was, it's always a bit awkward to say it about yourself, but it was a huge success. So many, many people started following us, started reading us, and we were sort of always in touch with what was happening in the city. And we wrote very deeply also about all the restaurants, about all the entrepreneurs. So I got back a lot of information from Rotterdam in the first place. And I combined it with my knowledge from the market and from building communities and listening to people, and the data from our platform, and the people that I met together gave me a really good opportunity to actually see what's going on in the world of food and drinks. So at one point people started asking me, can you share some of your insights? Can you come to our conference? Can you help my company? Because we need to introduce this or that. And then at one point I think, I'm a food trend watcher, right? I'm telling which trends are going to come, and I'm not, in Dutch we say, you're not married to this title. You know, it's not like that. It's, I want to be a food trend watcher. That is, defines me purely, but I see what's happening in the world of food and drinks, and I think I'm quite good at seeing what is going to happen in the world of food and drinks. And that knowledge I share it in the media, like on my own platforms, of course, like the podcast, like the buik, but also in the media, like the national television or magazines or the national papers, and a lot in front of groups like conferences or keynotes, or so that's a bit how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. It's so nice, like, to have a passion and to manage to transform it in your own work, right? Yeah. With a community around you that supports it.
Yeah, that's very nice of you to say, because I really love what I do. You know, this food, you are also in food and drinks. It's such a passionate community, and almost everybody, not everybody, but almost everybody loves to eat and drink, you know, and the people that work in this business, they're all, they're either very hospitable, you know, when they work in hospitality, or they're very, driven by the product or the produce or whatever they make. And that's also really, that makes it for a very nice job, because you're always around very interesting people.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. And have you already started looking into the trends for next year?
Yes, actually. Well, it's December. We're in December now, right? And December and January are the trend months, you know? But I look at trends 12 months per year, you know? So all the time, 365 days per year, all the time. But still, this time is a bit more like in terms of doing trends, you know? So I have my general trends. My drive is I have a system for that, a model that works really well. And I'm not going to change that now because it's turning 2026, you know, because it's good for the last 5 years and it's just tweaking. But I also like to look in a bit more tiny trends or more like a lower trend or trends that are focused on a special part of the market. And that I'm already writing up, and I'll be sending that on the, I'll be publishing that on the Buik and on my personal newsletter soon. So somewhere halfway December.
Okay. Yeah. Because I imagine that when you look at trends, you can see different trends, for example, in restaurants, in cafes, in like what is sold also like in retail and so on. So you really have to analyze like the different parts of the food scene, let's say. Can you tell us a bit more about how this process works for you? So do you really go in person like to a lot of different places and taste different things, talk to different people, or are you doing more research or so online, or yeah, how does it work?
All of the above. So I think you're really right. Let's start with your introduction of the question. You're absolutely right that food is such a vast world, such a vast industry, you know, and there's people that are trend watcher just for everything, you know, they know everything about everything. So I decided to be a trend watcher just, and I do like parentheses or what you say, you know, air quotes, because just about the world of food and drinks, which is still very big. So sometimes I'm talking to supermarkets or to packed consumer goods producers. Sometimes I'm talking to corporations of farmers. Sometimes I'm talking to people that have very small businesses or very big businesses, restaurant owners, like the biggest restaurant company in the world is client of mine, you know, so, and everything in between. So I like to have the diverseness because I think it's already a niche, you know, food is a niche, you know, so I like to see as much as possible from technology to everything in between. And how I do it is, I think you need to experience a lot. So I'm not a very quantitative trend researcher. Of course I can if somebody asks me, but I'm very qualitative. So I like to see things around me. I like to see in trend watching, you always say one occasion is no trend, two occasions is no trend, three occasions is a trend, which is of course it's a bit of an ironic way to look at things, but still it is. You have to see it at different places. You have to recognize patterns. You have to see changes before other people see changes. And that helps if you talk to a lot of people. I think that's my most important part of my business, is meeting people, talking to people, and listening to them. You have to do a lot of things, so experiencing, like you said, go out, eat out, travel, to go to different places, try new things, don't go to the same place too much. And the last part is you have to read and listen and watch a lot of things. So podcasts, for example, I listen to at least 20 podcasts per week. I read like 10 different newsletters per month. I read, of course, all the things that come on the Buik, which is of course very Dutch, but still it gives a good part of the a good vision of what's happening in Holland. And then there's a lot of other things I do, but this is the basics, like communicate, listen, do, and try to use media in your advantage.
Yeah, very cool. And what do you think if I pick a couple of trends that were like commented from our network, and then we can see if you also saw this trend here in the Netherlands?
Yes, I would love to, because I already read some of them and they're from all over the world. How did you get to this network, or how did you get to these people? Because I found it amazing to see these names from the Philippines and from Nigeria and from everywhere, you know?
Yeah, so basically slow food is a global movement, and it is formed of different local communities, and communities are grassroots groups of people, normally around 10 people, but also like more people that get together with a common goal to change the local food system. And then they establish a specific goal each year, and then they can stick to that goal or change it. For example, we can have like a local slow food community in Manila, let's say in the Philippines, that is working against local food waste. No? It's just an example. Or to preserve local food heritage. And with the youth network, we are focusing on youth communities as part of the global slow food movement. And with the youth, we mean young people between 18 to 32 years old. And these communities can be really of a broad group of people, like from very different backgrounds. So from farmers, communities, to gastronomes, to cooks, to activists, students. And all, they get all together to make a local change. And what I do in my work is that I'm in contact with these local communities, and I picked basically some people that I knew that they were really into like local gastronomy, and I just sent them a message or an email and I asked, hey, have you noticed any local food trends that you would like to share so that we can comment it on Slow Food the podcast? And then I got this feedback. Yeah, so this is a...
Okay, very, very clear. And it's, and you will... Here, listeners, I'm going to tease you already a bit, that they come from all over the world. That is really nice. And the insights are sometimes very, they're always very local, but actually sometimes they feel very global as well, you know, you, because they're so recognizable between these different members of your community.
Yeah, actually, I was also surprised like to find like these common traits, but I also think it's because now we are, I mean, we still have, of course, like local trends, but it's still a globalized world. So there is a lot of cross contamination.
Yeah,
no?
True.
Yeah. But something that I noticed that was really, that really struck me was this tendency of really looking at like hyper-local foods. So looking for local varieties, indigenous foods, and trying to bring it back, either in the original authentic recipes or with like a new style or like a more modern interpretation, but still giving value to what was the local tradition before.
I thought it was, that was one of the really things sticking out for me as well, showing up a lot. And what I thought was interesting was, or how I see it, is for a long time, and also the global village, and the world is a global village, had a kind of result that everybody almost started eating the same thing, you know, like only hamburgers or only certain sodas, you know. So and it's such a strong pushback at this right now, came also from this mini research you did, like, and how it's very nice and warm to see that these people are so in contact or you know, almost fighting for their local traditions and their local food ways. And I thought that was it was a positive thing of our research. And it was also very concrete, you know. It was not, we want to preserve our traditions. No, we have, if we're in the Philippines, there's indigenous foods, native crops, you know, and we're fighting for them to not get lost. We want them to stay, or we want to, in Nigeria, one of the we can mention his name later, but he was talking about gari and about fufu. And fufu, I actually know, even here in Rotterdam,
really?
We've heard about fufu, but gari, I never heard of. So this is good that people are thinking, okay, before it really gets lost, and maybe it's not, there's a lot of people in Nigeria probably know what it is, but still, it's important to hold on. And this was sometimes about dishes, sometimes about crops, and sometimes what I thought was really nice was a person from Uganda, and they said that they have the Rolex in Uganda, and this is not a watch, but this is a very famous street food in Uganda. And the good thing is I had opportunity to try this here in Rotterdam, because Rotterdam is a really international city because of the port that we have here and people that like to come here, like to live here. So I actually tried it. Too bad that the restaurant that served it closed like a half a year ago. But it's interesting to see that even such a specific dish all the way from Uganda can be in just one place here in Rotterdam.
What is it like, the Rolex? Can you describe it?
I will say it like the oh yeah, that's it. It's called Rolex because it's rolled X. So it's actually abbreviation, contraction of those two words, and it's like a sort of a pancake made out of eggs, which has been rolled and can be filled with anything. So there's different fillings, but it can be veggie, but it can be other things as well in there. And the good thing was, especially at least the one I ate, I was there like, oh, this is a new kitchen for me. I've never eaten Ugandan. So I tried three or... And the people were looking at me, but they were so hospitable. They were so nice. And I thought I'm doing something wrong, but I didn't know what I was doing. So then almost an entire table full of food came, you know, because... But I only ordered three dishes from the menu, but they were all so big. And it was so a lot. So after the Rolex, I was already quite full. I said, okay, can you please put the rest into a doggy bag, because I'm not going to eat it here anymore.
This is why they were looking at you. Like,
this is why they were thinking, this guy, he doesn't know our traditions or our dishes.
Nice. But yeah, but it's very interesting. It sounds also, something easy to replicate, right? Because it's in the end like rolled eggs that you can fill in with different things, and it's easy to adapt also to other food cultures, right? Or other places. So it's a very good one to try. And also something that you mentioned before, you mentioned like two dishes from Nigeria, which were garri and fufu. And me personally, I've never tried them, unfortunately, but I would really love to. And those ones, let me get the quote. I thought also they were like a very interesting example because they are byproducts of fermented cassava. So they come from this fermented root, like cassava, which is also called like a yuca. It's like a tuber, let's say. And see, until a few years ago, these dishes were looked at as something for poor people. Whereas now there's influencers that are bringing them back. So they are becoming something cool. And I thought it's so nice, right? To look at like our own food traditions and make them cool again with young people that are gonna, that give like a bit of new vitality, right? To these dishes. And I did a bit of research, and the garri, for what I saw, it looks like a sort of a porridge. Then the Nigerian people that are going to listen to this podcast can correct me if I'm wrong. Whereas the fufu, it's more a sort of a thick dough, still made of cassava, and you eat it together with a stew or something where you can like dip it in.
Yeah, or sort of dip it in and take it out almost. Yeah, yeah. It's like it can use almost like a spoon and then eat the spoon, for example. Ah. So it is. It's very fulfilling as well. So that's nice about the fufu.
Yeah. So this one was a very nice one, and then also the trend of using, for example, byproducts. It's something that it's really coming up. For example, we had also an intervention from the Polenzo Food Lab, which is part of the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy. And they told us that chefs, researchers, students and companies are increasingly working with byproducts as starting points for innovation, which I think it's super interesting, not to give a new value to things that were discarded before.
Yes, it's sustainable, but it's also very much about money. You know, for example, here in Holland, people will use the what's left over after creating beer, after making brewing beer. There's a lot of proteins and a lot of fibers in there, so they use it for something. They always used to first they threw it away, then they gave it to the animal, and they make feed out of it instead of food. And now they're trying to get all the important elements out of it and use it for real food for real people. And we see this on all levels happening in Holland and also all over the world. So it's a very normal thing to do, you know, especially if you come from a time which the world has been in for ages and ages, where food was scarce. Then you had to be you take care of your food, you know, you don't throw anything away. And now we live in a time that people throw away a third of all the things in the world is thrown away. So we're trying to regain this again and because of the waste of money and the waste of resources. So I really like this. And this can be very big, like Heineken is doing this in the Netherlands, which is one of the biggest brewers in the world, but also someone at a university is doing research for that. And some of your people in your community are actually working on just individual level all over the world at that. So I really like that.
Mm-hmm. It's part also of the concept of circularity, right? Like to really use everything that comes from a product and put it like back in the industry.
And what I think is interesting there, what I didn't realize until I saw the answers of the people from the community, I think food is very much about presentation as well. The world of social media has made food even more than it already was. It used to be very much about sustenance and about convenience, especially street food. And the last few years, drinks and food, they have all become sort of pictures, like really nice to see and to show on the Instagram and on the TikTok. And that led to a lot of extra plastic and ribbons and things you have to throw away, which is really a waste. But I like it because it looks beautiful and it looks better inside. A drink looks better in a plastic cup because you can see all the colors stacked on each other. And now what we're seeing, what I saw in a few of your replies, was that they are using actually, for example, banana leaves or other leaves to use as a packaging, also for street food. So, and it also looks good. You know, so it's not a step down in terms of how you can show off on Instagram or TikTok. It's actually a step up, and you use some byproducts that you otherwise wouldn't use, and you don't have extra plastic, which is going to be discarded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. So this came out from different countries, not the team of the banana leaves, whereas the for example, the problem of the packages was mentioned by Roger from Bolivia. He's a gastronomer and professor in Cochabamba. And he mentioned that a lot of especially young people use these disposable plastic containers, especially for drinks. He mentioned that there is a big trend with acai, for example, as a street food as well, a trend with matcha and so on. But like all these colorful drinks, they come with a disposable package, and this also creates a problem, let's say. And at the same time, there is like this interest in sustainability, interest in more healthy and natural foods also, and also clean labels from young people. So it's interesting also like this duality.
I think that's a really good one. And I think this is because we know so much about forever chemicals and PFAS and all these things. And this is like the trends, also this knowledge spreads really quickly. So I think the younger generation, especially generation that follows trends, will actually say, I don't want anything in plastic anymore. You know, I want it either in something that's going to stay probably glass or metal and not in plastic anymore, and especially not something we're going to throw away. So I think we're from a different angle, this waste problem, this disposable waste problem is going to get solved.
Mm-hmm. Let's hope.
Let's hope. Yeah.
And when it comes to drinks, since we mentioned, for well, I don't know if açaí you would consider it a drink or not, like Demi something boat. Halfway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. And which tendencies have you seen here?
Well, I thought it was interesting because açaí has been around the world at very like spotty places, you know, only very either trendy places or very healthy places. And like the last 5 years, it's been there's, for example, the Oakberry chain, which is it's growing like crazy. You know, it's opening and opening and opening. And it comes, of course, from Brazil, from the Amazon. So I thought it was interesting that your community member from Bolivia said something about this because it's close. Relatively close, so he will see it earlier than we see it. But in terms of drinks, the açaí they will do it as a bowl or as a drink. Both can be as a smoothie, and smoothies are coming up really quickly. Everything in terms of healthy, all the warm drinks, like I always call them like the morning drinks, the before PM drinks. They used to be coffee, of course, tea. Now they're all turning into sort of, big cans of milky, even plant-based milk or normal milk, milky, concoctions, which are like the matcha latte, the ube latte, the normal coffee latte, all these different ones in different colors.
What is the ube?
Ube is a Filipinian, mostly Filipinian, also a bit of a root, I think, if I'm correct. And it's very purple, and it's a bit of sweet. So it's used forever in the Philippines in desserts, and now it ends up also in drinks and in pastries, for example. So it's one of the flavors that is getting a lot of traction worldwide, also outside of the Philippines now. And what we see with drinks is that this morning moment is sort of replicated in the afternoon now. And where in the morning, like I said, it's warm. In the afternoon, it's usually cold. And they call it pick-me-ups, so afternoon pick-me-ups. So like, I think everybody who's been working for the last, in his life or her life or their life, they know that at 4 o'clock, you know, you need something to get maybe till 5 or 6 o'clock, and then you need to get home, and then you need to do something at home, and only then is the dinner, you know. So people need something to get them going in the end of the afternoon, and there's a whole class of drinks now, category of drinks coming up, which called afternoon pick-me-ups, and they have, especially if you look at the US, they're like blasters, chillers, refreshers, quenchers. They have all these names. They have all these bright colors. They have some energetic values, usually sugar, but they try to get rid of sugar, of course. So it's sort of a coffee, Red Bull kind of drinks, but then usually trying to make sure that there's not too much of the sugar and the caffeine in it. So it's really interesting development.
Okay, I've never heard about the pick-me-ups, you know, like as a term, so it's quite new to me. And you mentioned that these are normally cold, no? Whereas in the morning, they're more like a hot coffee.
And if you go, for example, to Southeast Asia, they will look at you like you, okay, they usually drink warm drinks, but they are much more used to cold drinks, mostly in terms of tea variants, you know, like the boba tea and the chilled teas and everything. So they already have a much broader category there that's doing this. But it's so a lot of the innovation comes from there, but also from drinks from Mexico, for example, or from South America.
Mm-hmm. But in this case, for example, like to understand a bit the context, would people drink it at the cafe or would they get
the
container, let's say, and eat it somewhere, drink it somewhere else?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's almost all of it is to go.
Okay.
So there is a container. And there is waste, of course, then. So that's interesting because it leads to more waste, actually, at this point. And what you see in the US is that the chains that are doing really well at this point, you can say the Starbucks competitors or the McDonald's competitors, they are doing mostly so well because they have fantastic drive-thrus. So they're really efficient. You drive there with your car, you order ahead, or you order in the AI machine. You say, I need a blaster chiller with these and these flavors. Yeah, 1, 2, 3. And you get it like 2 minutes later and you drive off again.
Wow. Okay.
So this is quite modern, yeah.
They should do a verso like a cycling in, you know, for the Netherlands.
Exactly, exactly.
If we you would cycle go and you there, drink.
If we would go there with our Rotterdam minds or Dutch minds, everything on the bike and everything in our tote bag, which then it wouldn't work. You know, we would be lost there.
Yesterday, actually, we had like a dinner at the office, like a Borrel dinner, which is like a early dinner, no? Like here in the Netherlands.
Yes, drinks. It's office drinks.
Yeah. But yesterday we made pizza.
Okay.
So for the first time, I really felt I'm becoming Dutch because I had like these 5 pizzas on top of my bike. And I was like cycling with one hand and the other one holding the pizza. And I was like, I can do it. I can do it.
This is part of your integration ritual. It's true.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I was foreseeing myself like drinking with one hand the, what was the name again of the pick me ups?
Pick me up, afternoon pick me ups. Yes.
Yeah, pick me up and driving the bike with the other hand. Nice. And also, Gijsbrecht, something that I remember you mentioned that you also saw as a trend, it was in our previous conversation, is like this tendency to the unplugged.
Yeah.
Right? That people arrive to a place and they want to be completely detached.
Disconnected. Yes. Uh-huh. Detached is also a very nice word. Yeah. So I call this in Dutch, we call the combination of hotels, restaurants, cafes. We call this horeca. This is in more European countries. They call this combination. And I call this horeca unplugged. So this is that we're going to plug ourselves from the connection from the internet, and it can also be a connection that is of course wireless, so it's more of a mental plug than a literal plug, which means that when we go already in the clubs, we already see it. So when we go to a club, we have to leave our phones at home, or we have to put it in a locker, and there's special pouches where you can put them in, so you don't have connection to the 5G network, so you can't photograph, you can't film, you can't share content. And it's also to create a sort of safe space, because putting stuff on the internet also feels, for some people, they don't want to dance anymore, they feel awkward, they don't want to be caught on, like they're doing something different. You know how kids are, you know, and even older people, they don't want to be different than the rest. So we saw it first in the clubs, I mean, now we see it coming towards cafes and restaurants as well, and bars. The people say, okay, when you're at our place, we want you to be focused on the people you are with, or the people who are in the same room as you are, and the food and drinks that are on your table, and the hospitality you're getting from the waiter or from the waitress or the chef that's at your table explaining the dish. We don't want you filming it because you forget half of what the chef had said, and you have a completely different experience. So I see ahead, especially for next year and the next few years, horeca unplugged, a lot of places where they ask you either nicely or they force you to leave your phone in either your pocket or leave them at home.
Okay, so interesting. I went to a cafe here in Rotterdam where there was written like, you can come and work with your laptop every day of the week, but in the weekends we don't want to see any devices.
Yeah.
So that it's and there was really like a paper on the tables, no, that was saying that. So.
And they tried to enforce it more and more. In the beginning was sort of nicely, and now they're saying, okay, no. And they're going to mention it, put it away. And the good thing is, a laptop is quite big, you know, so that's, you can see when someone uses a phone. Is like, usually people use it very sneaky because they also feel a bit awkward themselves, you know, because they know it's not what they should be doing. You know, they're a little, you know, addicted to their phone. So they always do it a bit like under the table, you know. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be an interesting movement, because it's not as easy to enforce as putting away your laptop.
Yeah, true. But also, I have the feeling that it's kind of connected to the, how to say, like, the need that we have to create like new rituals all the time. So like this could be also like a ritual, like to go to the cafe or to the restaurant totally unplugged. Yeah. But I see also like there is, for example, the ritual of the matcha, no? The ritual also like of the cacao preparation, for example, no? And yeah, there is like this need of mindfulness in exactly. a way of like cutting a space yeah. for yourself yeah. like to enjoy your coffee, to enjoy your moment.
It's very much in line, and not saying that because you're sitting next to me, but it's very much in line with slowing down, actually, you know, with the pace of the society is so high and people need to do so much and they have very little guidelines, things to go by. So they try to slow down. They try to find a ritual which has certain steps. That's why I like to grind my own coffee at home. You know, it takes me back from my computer. It takes me, and it costs me 5 minutes to make my own coffee. Or if I'm using your cacao, it also takes me 5 minutes to make it. And it's a mini ritual just for me, you know. And we will see this more and more in the horeca as well, in the restaurants and in the bars as well, because it creates a presence. Yeah, mindfulness is also a very good word. And it sounds very, in Dutch we say zweven, you know, like your mind is floating around there. It's not very concrete, not very economic, not very digital, not very hard, but it's especially the meaning, you know, you want to get away from all these things like the last 20 years, 25 years have been only that, you know? Mm-hmm. So now we want some more space for ourselves and let our minds wander a bit.
Yeah, and at the same time also reconnect more with nature, for example, and also like with local foods, no? And we come back to the topic of before, so like yeah. of, I think we had actually a person from Poland, Lea Balcerczak, that mentioned nostalgia, that yeah. I really like this term.
Very good term.
Yeah, right? So really looking at things of the past with yeah. a new look. But also like this nature theme is something that is coming up more and more, right? Yeah.
And if you are present and if you are connected in a real way, not through a screen, then you can also learn about this or hear from this or take the story into yourself. You know, if the chef is telling something about a dish, or you're at a farmer's market and somebody is selling you something from a person that is near, or even the cacao, your cacao is coming from far, but the story is really good, you can listen to it. And it doesn't work so well if you have a phone in your hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, very nice. And yeah, so for example, the topic of fermentation is something that is coming out from different countries, and also the search for this like fermented taste or also like umami flavor. It's something that we find. Have you found it also here? Like the trend of like fermentation.
It's really interesting to see fermentation worldwide happening, you know, because there's, if with my European focus or even Western focus, fermentation has been happening since the last 10 years, coming from Noma, mostly in Denmark, in Copenhagen. And they even have their own fermentation lab. They have their book on fermentation. They actually are selling their own ferments now, you know, like small packages of certain flavors that you can put on your food, for example, sauces or whatever ingredients. But it's everywhere, and it has been everywhere for thousands and thousands of years. And what I've found, and I don't know exactly what is fermented. When I'm in Thailand and I eat something, I know if the fish has been fermented or not, because you have it in your palate to know it or to not know it. But now I saw it from all these different countries. I thought that was really nice. And I think also the whole process of processing food, like the way we have done the last 150 years, took out fermentation a lot, because fermentation is also making sure that some food can last longer. And or fermentation is a way that the processed food still keeps on processing, you know, and we didn't want that in the factory. So we cut off the fermentation for the last, say, 100 years. And now we're opening it up again all over the world. All these old rituals and old traditions and old recipes are coming up again because we say, okay, we don't want too much ultra-processed foods anymore. So we go back to fermentation again.
Yeah, exactly. And also we allowed a bit more of differentiation in the same product, because if you ferment, you don't have the same result all the time. You can have like different flavors, and yeah, so people are more open also to accept that compared to like always the same standardized industrialized product that they could get.
Exactly. For example, natural wine is a good example for that, you know, so you every year can be a bit different. So, but that's okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. And to sum up with the podcast, what can we recommend to our listeners? What is like a call to action that we can leave them with?
I looked at what your community said to us, actually, to find this call to action to the listeners. And it was very much about trying to find where something comes from. So if you see a trend or even a flashy hype, for example, matcha, and you drink mango matcha with some vanilla inside and some cocoa water, then I'm not going to judge you, but it should be nice that you look into matcha. Where does it come from? It comes from Japan. What is the ceremony around it? Why did people drink it? Why is the matcha from early in the year better than later in the year? And I think you can do this as if you love food, and I think all our listeners do, you should and can always dive a bit deeper into, try to find the underlying history or the underlying economic drivers or the underlying culture from a country, and try to embrace that as well. And I think, or almost know, that your food will taste better when you do this.
Definitely. Yeah, and also from my more slow food perspective, I have the feeling that it's super important to really look at local food cultures, because by preserving these traditional dishes, you also preserve local biodiversity, you preserve local culture, you preserve a process that otherwise would have been lost. So it's really super important to keep these dishes alive, even if you interpret them with a new eye.
Make some new nostalgic food.
Exactly.
Of it.
Yes. Great. Thank you so much, Gijsbrecht. It was super interesting, this conversation, and super inspiring.
Thank you, Valentina. I feel completely the same way.